Chapter 3. Native Advertising, Publishers as Marketers. On January 14, 2013, the homepage of The Atlantic looked like it did on any other day. Same typeface, same white background, same picture layout. But something was amiss. The lead story seemed somehow, well, off. The headline read, David Miscavige leads Scientology to milestone year, with a subhead stating, under ecclesiastical leader David Miscavige, the Scientology religion expanded more in 2012 than in any 12 months of its 60-year history. Uncharacteristically, and in opposition to traditional journalistic standards, the piece effusively listed the institution's numerous global achievements with superlatives that proclaimed unparalleled growth, and described the leader as a driving force and unrelenting in his work. The pictures showcased church openings around the world and were captioned to note that thousands of people attended these events, though there was no verification of those numbers and no evidence in the pictures. There are clues that this content was native advertising, a sales pitch disguised to be integral to the site, rather than typical Atlantic fare. Beyond writing that would undoubtedly not pass muster with the publication's editorial board, it was clearly marked with a bright yellow highlighted bar proclaiming sponsor content. At the end of the piece, the Scientology logo and the text, "Sponsor Content Presented by the Church of Scientology," are clearly displayed. The publication thought that was enough to designate this as advertorial content. It was not. The problem wasn't that it was native advertising, which can be done without tricking the reader. The problem was that it was native advertising done badly. Let's break it down. Native advertising doesn't look like advertising. It fits seamlessly into the flow of the publication. And it has symbols or text that label the article or posting as advertising. But this piece was too native, too Atlantic-ish. Visitors to the site got suckered into the content, and once they started reading, they knew fairly quickly that this was not a typical story. Readers were furious, and rightly so. The response to this trickery was palpable. In a quite pointed tweet, one freelance journalist who writes for The Atlantic posted, "What the fuck is this shit?" and provided a link to the page. News coverage, from The Washington Post to NBC Nightly News, lambasted The Atlantic for providing Scientology with such a prominent space in a well-respected publication. Journalists were not only upset by the content itself, but by the lack of ability to comment on it. Early commentary was unanimously positive, about as positive as the piece itself, yet critical voices could not get their negative commentary posted, which raised suspicions. They would come to learn that this was because the comments were being moderated by the marketing team, not the editorial staff. And their job, unlike editorials, is to filter out comments that attack their client. A few negative comments did ultimately make it through the censors, such as, "I guess money talks. You better hope people don't walk away from your publication for allowing this ruse." And one of my personal favorites, "If The Atlantic wanted to do something degrading and pathetic for money, they should have tried scat porn. It would have been less embarrassing to explain to their children." By the time the nightly news broadcasts were over at 11:30 p.m., the content had been pulled. The following morning, The Atlantic guiltily apologized. "We screwed up. It shouldn't have taken a wave of constructive criticism, but it has, to alert us that we've made a mistake, possibly several mistakes. We now realize that as we explored new forms of digital advertising, we failed to update the policies that must govern the decisions we make along the way. It's safe to say that we are thinking a lot more about these policies after running this ad than we did beforehand. In the meantime, we have decided to withdraw the ad until we figure all of this out. We remain committed to and enthusiastic about innovation in digital advertising, but acknowledge, sheepishly, that we got ahead of ourselves. We are sorry, and we're working very hard to put things right. Nice try, but duplicitous. The publisher was pushing the limits to see how far native advertising would go, and they lost. Advertising is advertising, and this article was produced by the client like most advertising is. Before any ad is put into a publication, it is reviewed for content. If the ad is unacceptable, don't publish it. It's really hard to imagine that editorial or even the marketing staff thought this was acceptable on any level. The Scientology ad came up again and again as the worst-case scenario for native advertising. No one I spoke with could provide other egregious cases or anything more recent. That puzzled me. Why aren't there more examples? Have we become more accepting of native ads? Is it that the marketers have gotten better at hiding them? Or is it just that we don't know the ads are there? It seems to be a bit of all of the above. A few years ago, pieces like this got our shorts in a knot, and you could just hear fingers banging on keyboards demanding transparency in journalism. Today, not so much. Granted, the Scientology piece is effusive in its praise for an institution that most find deplorable, or at least mildly offensive, which would explain the pushback. However, is this really any different from other native advertising we see now? There was no outcry when the New York Times ran a puff piece on urbanization and sustainability for Shell Oil. There was no angry public lambasting when Chevron had a piece about changing energy needs that was really about the competitive world market for energy. Admittedly, there was some negative response to the same paper's piece for Goldman Sachs, a bit of puffery that was meant to improve the company's reputation after the financial crisis. That negative response, however, has become the exception. The Times has gotten really clever at integrating advertising with editorial content, and so have other publishers. On mobile platforms especially, native ads can be extremely elusive, and this is important because everything is moving toward mobile. In a particularly underhanded example, men attending the South by Southwest festival found themselves matched on the dating app Tinder with Ava, a stunningly beautiful 25-year-old woman. After some short banter, the conversation turns to where the couple should meet in person. "If you could meet me anywhere, where would you choose?" asks Ava. "Considering we're both in Austin right now, I'd have to say Austin," responds the prospective date. Ava answers, "You are clever. You've passed my test. Take a look at my Instagram and let me know if I've passed yours. Smile. At Meet Ava." Thing is, Ava's a robot, and the Instagram account was a native ad for the movie Ex Machina. Integrated content of a more serious nature can also appear offline. In 2015, CNN announced that they were forming an in-house studio to produce advertising that looked like news. Of course, they do not call it advertising. They call it Courageous. That's the name of their new marketing arm, which is made up of journalists and filmmakers and headed by a former creative director from Ogilvy Entertainment, a division of advertising giant Ogilvy and Mather. While Courageous hasn't produced anything to date, or at least they aren't promoting the fact that they have, you can get an idea of where this is heading by looking at case studies of what CNN has done overseas. Leading Women is an on-air segment, a monthly program consisting of interviews with influential women, from Bobby Brown to Oprah Winfrey to Sheryl Sandberg, as well as online content. It is used to promote high-end watchmaker Omega. Programs and interviews are done by CNN's on-air talent, and the segment looks analogous to soft news pieces the network would air. While the online content was obviously advertising, the pieces on CNN's air were not, or at least not that I could tell. Even as they pander to advertisers, CNN and other news organizations are twisting themselves in knots trying to maintain their credibility while producing camouflaged corporate content. Producers claim to be working toward transparency, but come on, really? As an executive from Turner, CNN's parent company, said, "This isn't about confusing editorial with advertising. This is about telling advertisers' stories, telling similar stories, but clearly labeling that and differentiating that." He even went on to say, "This is CNN. We're not here to blur the lines." Does anyone believe that nonsense? What he and the advertising clients are counting on, and what they are paying for, is that the patina of trustworthiness associated with an unbiased news source with CNN's journalistic credentials will come to be associated with the products and services that appear within their content. As the no-nonsense, tell-it-like-it-is Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, told Al Jazeera, "Advertisers aren't stupid. When they pay money for something, they expect to get money in return. With native advertising, the advertiser's ad seems to be a little bit more under the aegis of a respectable news organization. If it didn't work like an ad, they wouldn't pay for it like an ad. And that's the important thing to remember, whether it's called storytelling or content or co-branding. An ad is an ad is an ad." This is at the heart of black ops advertising, including native. It only works if the content looks more like editorial than it does like advertising. Publishers are caught between a rock and a hard place. They have to make money. Most of the money is going into digital, and increasingly that money is funding native. In the case of The Atlantic, digital advertising at the time the Scientology ad appeared made up 59% of ad revenues for the company, and approximately half of that is attributable to native. And they are not alone. Adoption of native advertising is widespread, with research suggesting that between 62 to 75% of publishers are offering this service, with another 16% having planned to jump on the native advertising bandwagon in 2015. That means that only about 10% of publishers are not looking into offering a native advertising format. That said, native advertising has not, and likely will not, replace all other forms of online promotion. Ben Williams, editor for digital at New York Magazine, noted that banner ads, display ads, and homepage takeovers remain that publication's biggest revenue driver. That is because, as discussed in the last chapter, marketers still need to facilitate consumers' relationship with the brand, and simply seeing an ad is valuable, even if no one clicks on it. So while native is growing, for now it still constitutes only a small piece of marketers' budgets at 5% or less, while native makes up about 20% of publishers' revenues. However, spending is growing, and growing rapidly, as mobile becomes the go-to format and news feeds dominate. In November of 2014, eMarketer was predicting that native ads would reach $8.8 billion by 2018. A mere 3 months later, Business Insider and the IAB were predicting spending to be $7.9 billion in 2015, with that figure almost tripling to $21 billion by 2018. It is easy to see why this has gained in popularity. No one reads banner ads, and full-screen takeover ads are appealing for advertisers, but they don't have the pass-along factor. Native ads, on the other hand, circumvent clutter and grab our attention. We are 25% more likely to look at a native ad compared to a banner, and will view a native ad 53% more frequently. Not only that, we are more likely to share this content, and we have higher purchase intent after viewing native content. The stealth nature of these ads is what makes them particularly appealing. Being similar in tone with the publication makes it difficult to parse native advertisements from editorial content. According to Meredith Levien, executive vice president of advertising for the New York Times, readers spend similar amounts of time with sponsored posts, that is, advertising, as they spend with legitimate news stories. Some paid posts have even outpaced news stories. The question is, though, did readers know they were paid posts? We just don't know. Native advertising. If you are confused about what native advertising is and how to spot it, you are not alone. Marketers themselves are bamboozled. A survey noted, respondents, marketers, commented about their lack of knowledge about native advertising, did not know what the term referred to, or had never heard of it. Even industry insider website Mashable asked the question, "What is native advertising? Depends on who you ask." The Internet Advertising Bureau, or IAB, has this definition: paid ads that are so cohesive with page content, assimilated into the design, and consistent with the platform behavior that the viewer simply feels that they belong. Better is that of GigaOM founder Om Malik, a sales pitch that fits right into the flow of information. Or, more frankly, native advertising is content camouflaged to look like other content in the hopes that we will read it and share it. But that doesn't explain it all either, because examples can be wide-ranging and ads are disguised in different ways. The Scientology ad looked like a magazine article. CNN's content looks like a celebrity interview segment. A humorous video on The Onion about a man obsessed with removing Internet Explorer from everyone's computer is actually an ad for Microsoft, created by the website's creative agency, The Onion Labs. In yet another example, Gawker did one better by creating a piece called "We've Disguised This Newcastle Ad as an Article to Get You to Click on It," which was an ad for beer and a commentary on native advertising, all at the same time. Finally, in one of the more offensive cases, Wired presented an article written by a widely respected scholar, MIT's Grant McCracken, about how TV viewing habits are changing. It says things like, people are not watching predictable shows with happy wind-ups by the end of each episode. They are not watching junk TV. They are watching great TV, House of Cards and Orange is the New Black. Why not say Walking Dead or Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones? Because the article was sponsored by Netflix, that's why. Still worse, the article never addresses the social or economic consequences of binge-watching, or the fact that we have to pay for Netflix while TV used to be free. This is all very interesting, but how are you supposed to tell what's news and what's not? What's reality and what's corporate puffery? How are you supposed to know? Truth is, sometimes you can't. But if you know what to look for, these ads can start to become more obvious. Let me break this down. Types of native advertising. The Internet Advertising Bureau, or IAB's, Native Advertising Playbook outlined 6 types of native advertising, including in-feed units, paid search units, recommendation widgets, promoted listings, and custom, or can't-be-contained, formats. You don't need to know all of these, and most of them we will dispense with quickly. First, paid search units and promoted listings are the ads that you see at the top of a search engine like Google, as well as the advertising that runs down the side of the search page. Most of us are familiar with these. On the other hand, you might be surprised to learn, as I was, that pictures with a headline at the bottom of a web page that say, "From Around the Web," are also a form of native advertising called recommendation widgets. These sponsored links make suggestions for content based on what you've been looking at online. Produced by companies like Outbrain, ShareThrough, and Taboola, the ads look like the publisher's site, but they link to the advertiser's page. Both of these forms of native advertising are of less concern, as the promotional aspect is fairly obvious, or is quickly made so. 2 types of native ads are more obscured and therefore of more interest. They are in-feed ads and custom ads. We will look at both in depth here. In-feed ad units. In-feed units appear within media news feeds, thus the name. As native advertising, they look similar to other content, but contain some minimal labeling to denote that they're advertising. On Twitter, for example, commercial tweets have a really small gray arrow in a box next to the word promoted that appears at the bottom of the tweet. On Facebook, native ads say, Susie Smith likes Uber, or suggested post in ghosted type above the post, and sponsored in faded type appears below the company's logo. Or at least it was like that until July 2015, when Facebook tweaked the format to make it more subtle, adjustments of a kind I saw happen again and again. Sponsored is now under the company name, and the thumbs up button replaced the words like page, making these sponsor indicators more obscure. On both sites, it is incredibly easy to miss these sponsor cues. Beyond the major social sites, in-feed ads are becoming ubiquitous. They appear in everything from music sites like Pandora and iHeartMedia to respected news providers like Slate.com, Business Insider, Salon.com, Vox, and Talking Points Memo, TPM, to name just a few. The in-feed native advertising for most of these sites can be discerned if you know what to look for. Words like sponsored and promoted content appear in a colored bar somewhere in the post, but you have to really look. Native ads are only part of these sites' arsenal. They also employ a variety of techniques, including product placement in their video content and custom content, which, as we will hear in a moment, is far more camouflaged. Given all this, it is safe to assume that most sites you visit, particularly if you access the site via mobile, have native advertising on them. There are a couple of different types of in-feed ads. Linked ads redirect you to an external site, much like the recommendation widgets do. If you have ever been on Facebook and clicked on Candy Crush by mistake, you've come face to face with this type of ad. Alternatively, embedded ads don't require you to leave the site to view the ad. Click on a video and you remain on Twitter. Finally, endemic in-feed units are the most widespread version of native advertising. These units are usually written by the publication to replicate the site's appearance and voice, sometimes in collaboration with the brand, and they appear in the feed with a label indicating that the content has a marketer behind it. Publishers creating ads for marketers has helped eliminate the possibility of another Scientology snafu, a situation that arose in part because the article was not written by Atlantic staff writers. Today, in-house advertising departments have become standard operating procedure. The model here is BuzzFeed, more in a moment, where the publisher creates the content with input from the advertiser. Alternatively, Forbes' Brand Voice invites marketers to create content that appears on their site and in the print publication. This is a bit more controversial, in that this site allows marketers to write posts on the same platform as Forbes' writers and contributors, decimating the church-state wall. In all of these cases, the content is labeled as promotion, though there is not a uniform term for it, which adds to content confusion. Google and YouTube use advertisement or ad. Twitter uses promoted or promoted by. Less obvious are Facebook, LinkedIn, and Yahoo, which use sponsored or sponsored by XYZ company or sponsored content or sponsored post, while BuzzFeed and Huffington Post favor presented by XYZ company and featured partner. Forbes uses their trademarked brand voice, which assumes the reader already knows they are looking at content that has been paid for. This conglomeration of terms belies publishers' claims to transparency. Rather, transparency standards vary widely. As Bob Garfield, host of On the Media, former columnist for Ad Age, and vocal critic of Native Ads, has so aptly noted, if publishers really wanted to be transparent, they would label it advertising instead of using weasel words like those just listed. Moreover, consumers are confused by the labeling. A 2014 survey by the IAB and Edelman PR said that 41% of consumers said the ads were clearly identified. But that means that a far larger majority, 59%, thought they were not. Indications are that this already subtly promoted content will get even more subtle. As mentioned, Facebook has been fine-tuning their layout, and so has Twitter. In April 2015, Twitter changed their yellow arrow icon next to the word promoted into the now faded gray one, so as to replicate other social sites. This may cause some people to click on advertising by mistake, but you can avoid that by looking for the stray symbols and checking for whatever promotional language the site decides to use. Until recently, no rules or guidelines existed for labeling these ads as there are for print advertorials. That changed in December 2015, when the Federal Trade Commission came out with guidelines for native advertising, which called for uniform labeling of sponsored content. Not surprisingly, the IAB responded by saying the section of the guidelines called Clarity of Meaning, subtitled Disclosures Must Be Understandable, was overly prescriptive. This response is a clear indication that advertisers are not as committed to transparency as they claim. BuzzFeed. When it comes to endemic in-feed native advertising and social sharing, no one does it better than BuzzFeed. The numbers speak for themselves. BuzzFeed gets more than 200 million unique visitors per month. Most of that comes via social media. 75% of people come to the site because of sharing. BuzzFeed dominates with millennials. 50% of visitors are 18 to 34. At a marketing industry conference in 2014, Jonah Peretti, the company's founder and CEO, explained that a simple question drives everything BuzzFeed does. How do you make things that people love and love to share? This is of paramount importance because so much of BuzzFeed's traffic comes from millennials sharing their content. Peretti learned the importance of sharing through experiences he had in the early 2000s. When Peretti was a student at the MIT Media Lab, Nike had just launched the Nike ID, which was a customizable sneaker. Peretti tried to order the shoes with the word sweatshop printed on the side. Given Nike's issues with international labor, it is not surprising that the company wrote back and said that the word was inappropriate, so they would not produce the shoe for him. Peretti's response was to ask if Nike could at least send him a picture of the young Vietnamese girl who was sewing up the Nike ID shoes overseas. Nike let it drop after that. Peretti did not. He forwarded the email exchange to friends, who sent it to other friends, who sent it to their friends, and so on. The Nike email was Peretti's initial foray into understanding the impact of viral content. At the same time that Peretti was figuring out what makes content go viral, other future BuzzFeed executives were having similar experiences. Zay Frank, the head of BuzzFeed Video, was creating visual content like the Atheist Game, www.zayfrank.com/atheist/, and its variation, the Buddhist Game, as well as a site that showed friends how he wanted them to dance at a party he was having. Zay's web server company told him he had a bill in the tens of thousands of dollars because of all the traffic he was generating. For Ben Smith, the company's editor-in-chief, epiphany came while at a press event. He watched traditional reporters call in news stories to appear in the next day's papers. He figured out he could type the story on his BlackBerry, post it on a blog, and beat the traditional reporters to the punch. All three, then, realized there's a way to reach people that's divorced from the way media works. It's not business. It felt cool and interesting, so we began exploring it. All that learning was turned into BuzzFeed, an entertainment and news website that provides mostly short, snackable content, be it advertising or not. The site is known for its listsicles and quizzes and just about anything to do with cute cats. David Carr in the New York Times explained the site as reverse engineering what Peretti had done as co-founder of HuffPo, saying, "At the Huffington Post, Peretti used search optimization to create a gaudy funhouse behind a serious front page. At BuzzFeed, the funhouse was the point of it all. The main headers on the home page told the story. LOL, cute, win, fail, OMG, geeky, trashy, and WTF. So while the company is moving into hard news, few people consider the site for that content, given its origins as an aggregator of memes and barrel-scraping viral content, even with Ben Smith's political credentials. That funhouse content is fundamental to the mission of creating items that people will share. BuzzFeed relies on technology that seeks out viral internet content, puts that through an editorial process, and feeds the content to visitors. One of the first successful pieces of content on the site was something they call Disaster Girl, which is a picture that had already had some traction on the internet. An ominous-looking little girl appears in the foreground of a picture in which a house is engulfed in flames. The odd smirk on her face made visitors wonder if she was somehow involved in this crime. She was not. People began photoshopping her picture into the front of a number of different disaster shots, and BuzzFeed posted these mashups. Disaster Girl appeared everywhere from Jesus' crucifixion to the invasion of Poland to the OJ trial. Popular posts like Disaster Girl are heavily promoted. As a former BuzzFeed executive put it, "We feed the winners and starve the losers." The goal is to create a continuous circle of sharing and viewing and sharing again. To keep the cycle in perpetual motion, BuzzFeed constantly makes media and constantly learns from it. Creatives can keep posting content, and they can immediately see whether an idea connects with an audience, a technique now widely used by most content sites. Humorous, mindless, irreverent content makes up the bulk of what appears on BuzzFeed. That and cats. This lightweight content is used to attract the Bored at Work network, millennials who are at their desk during lunch looking for a lift and a laugh that they can share with friends. BuzzFeed's cycle of sharing, analyzing, creating, and recreating goes for its native advertising as well. Advertising, like other content on the site, is meant to be shared. That's why BuzzFeed does not use banner ads. Rather, the site works with advertisers to create content that is entertaining, emotion-inducing, and easy to share. Said Peretti, the company is taking all the ways people consume media and extending that to solutions for brand partners. So we do lists and quizzes and animations and custom integrations and videos, and whenever we develop a new format, we will extend that format to branded content. A quiz for HBO, for example, was "How would you die in Game of Thrones?" And they created "Which Barbie doll are you?" for Mattel, both of which received more than 1 million views. They created videos called "The Evolution of the Burrito" for Taco Bell, "Why We Get Tattoos" for Spike TV, "What Kind of Thinker Are You?" for GE, a promotion that included first a quiz to determine visitors' thinking style, and then videos to explain each style in more detail, combining the best of both marketing worlds. Probably their most well-known sponsored video is, not surprisingly, about a cat. Dear Kitten, which was created for Purina, has more than 21 million views just on YouTube, and has been so successful that it spawned a series of spin-offs. Sponsored content, then, sits seamlessly side by side with news stories. And like the news stories, sponsored content is meant to be shared. These pieces are marked as sponsored, or say, promoted. But if you are reading these pieces on your mobile device, and most people do, these notations are easy to miss. BuzzFeed's point of difference, for now, is that they have figured out what people share through their analytics and why people share through social listening, and they've transferred that to assist advertisers. This explains BuzzFeed's appeal. They create content that will convert paid media to earned media. As Will Hayward, BuzzFeed's vice president in Europe, explained, "It's not about eyeballs on BuzzFeed.com. It's about creating content for brands and distributing that on Facebook, which has more than 1 billion users. That's a pretty huge audience we can deliver messages to." It's all about the conversation. That's what BuzzFeed understood before anyone else. Peretti claims that he intends BuzzFeed to become a legitimate news outlet, but it will be difficult for a site known as the List and Kitten Network to gain credibility, given advertising's vaunted place in the company and given their habit of blurring church and state, even while they take pains to proclaim loudly that they do nothing of the sort. The company stirred up commotion in early 2015 when it pulled an article about Dove products that poked fun at the brand. Dove is owned by Unilever, which is a major advertiser on the site. Gawker called them out on the deletion, saying, "The reporter's post was legitimate criticism of an exploitative marketing campaign underwritten by one of the largest and most powerful advertisers on the planet. In other words, the reason her post was necessary, in a way so many BuzzFeed posts are not, seems to be the very reason BuzzFeed deleted it." News director Ben Smith did a mea culpa on Twitter, and the article was restored. The reporter, however, left the company and did not return. This is not the first time BuzzFeed has done this. In 2013, ad critic Mark Duffy was fired from BuzzFeed for attacking Axe, another Unilever product. He claimed he was asked to dial back his criticism and delete posts to appease advertisers. We can only wonder at the critical content that never even makes it to the consideration stage because it does not fit the native advertising environment. BuzzFeed claims there can be no qualms about its integrity because they distinctly mark sponsored content. Says Mark Fracht, CFO, "We do our best to label commercial content. If it's being promoted by a brand, we specifically say so. The other thing is that it's engaging. Consumers are happy that they're reading a promoted item, and the proof is that they share it on Facebook and Twitter. If they didn't like the content, they wouldn't be sharing it." But do they know it is advertising? That's one bit of analytics the company hasn't done, or if they have, they have not made it public. Moreover, Peretti's attitude toward the blurred line is evident in a comment he made at Advertising Age's digital conference in 2012. "People still worry about the line between editorial and advertising. The bigger distinction is now between advertising that sucks and ads that are engaging and are ripe for sharing." And this is from a guy who claims he wants to get into hard news. Perhaps the most telling is that BuzzFeed is listed on Hoover's, the financial information company database, as an advertising agency. Not so their competitors. Facebook, Google, and Twitter are all listed as internet publishing, broadcasting and search, and portals. Peretti claims a separation between church and state, but the company's reputation and history make it impossible to take him at face value. Whatever journalistic integrity they might have is fundamentally undermined. As they are, BuzzFeed has influenced a number of other sites which have implemented similar strategies, not all of whom are hiding the advertising. A good example here is ThrillList, a site that caters to urban male millennials, and the native advertising campaign they did for General Electric. As Paul Josephson, VP of Integrated Marketing, told me, The problem that GE was facing was that they no longer have a consumer product division. They needed a way to connect with consumers, particularly young guys interested in tech who might want to work for the company. Built around the 45th anniversary of the moon landing, Thrillist wrote a series of articles a la BuzzFeed, 11 things you didn't know about the Apollo missions, 10 reasons why the Apollo astronauts were certified badasses, etc., highlighting GE's role in making this event happen. All this led up to a limited edition moon sneaker produced by GE, the company that had also produced the rubber for the boots and the helmets used in the moon landing. 100 sneakers made to look like moon boots, selling at $196.90, or $19.69, were sold on Thrillist's e-commerce site, jackthreads.com. They were a huge hit. "They sold out in 7 minutes," claims Thrillist CEO Ben Lehrer. In fact, the sneakers became so popular that they were selling on eBay for $2,000. This advertising would not have worked for GE if their participation was hidden. It was not. GE logos were prominently displayed throughout. I asked Josephson who he considered his key competitors. I was surprised when he didn't say BuzzFeed. He explained why. Unlike BuzzFeed, Thrillist is not primarily a media company. It is an e-commerce one. One might call it a native shopping experience. This economic structure and integration of buying within the content experience is what makes this so different from traditional media. The company derives between 70 and 80% of its revenue from JackThreads, making it far less dependent on advertising than their competitors. So while Peretti may be getting the buzz, Thrillist is better positioned as a company. Thrillist is better positioned as a company. Not only do they have a business model that is difficult to reproduce, unlike BuzzFeed, but they also have email lists and local penetration, which would be difficult and costly to replicate. Only the companies that are totally dependent on advertising have a vested interest in not flaunting their sponsorships. Customized content. Customized content is created by the publisher to look like newspaper and online articles, and like the name suggests, it is specifically produced. What makes this different from the work of BuzzFeed and others is that these ads do not appear within a news feed. Like The Atlantic, most organizations stumbled with their first outings of custom content. A year after the Scientology ad, The New York Times ran a flat-footed piece about millennials and computers, sponsored and created by the computer company Dell. The online publication Gawker presented an uninspired fake article about how to be a nerd babe as a promotion for TBS's program King of the Nerds. After these missteps, companies developed more formal in-house studios, or labs, devoted to creating native advertising content. Former journalists staff many of these in-house marketing departments, which explains why these ads are virtually identical to the editorial content. The Washington Post, owned by Amazon's Jeff Bezos, took the lead in custom native by starting Brand Connect in 2013 and allowing posts on their home page. Like other traditional newspapers, they fervently state that the newsroom is not involved in the creation of this content. The Washington Post also offers Brand Connect Perspective, a service similar to Forbes' Brand Voice that allows organizations to submit their own commentary to be featured on the Post's opinion section online. Bayer provided a piece titled Modern Agriculture is Based on Sound Science, that was written by a company executive. Across the top of the page, it says Perspectives, and the Bayer Crop Science logo appears on the article, but the look and feel of the page is still very much that of the site's op-ed space. More obscured are the news pieces. Keeping Road Cars in Formula One shape has all the identifying tags and logos we have come to expect, but the landing page is filled side to side and top to bottom with a picture of a spectacularly flashy sports car and a headline in ginormous type. The visual is so stunning and the type and colors so overwhelming that the sponsor mention is easily overlooked. In this case, the story about a partnership between Shell and Ferrari stresses the importance of changing a car's oil often. It is hard to imagine anyone being fooled by this content, as the sponsor is mentioned again and again and again. For now, this all seems innocuous, but we cannot trust that advertiser indicators will always be this obvious, especially when the team creating this content sits in the marketing group but looks for inspiration in the newsroom, according to an article in Adweek entitled, "The Washington Post's Native Ads Get Editorial Treatment, Borrowing from the Newsroom." In the case of the Washington Post, there's also the Bezos connection, which tends to mean Machiavellian approaches to profit generation. A year after the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal launched an in-house team called WSJ Custom Studios. This group is housed within the newspaper's advertising department. Their website notes, "The studio crafts stories that engage consumers and elevate the conversation for brands. Its global team of award-winning editors, designers, and interactive developers are all held to the high standards for which the Wall Street Journal is known, resulting in highly original and credible content that resonates with the client's target audience." Ugh. This group offers not only native advertising, but custom infographics, research and white papers, and campaign measurement. What I found particularly interesting were the content hubs, which could be offered within WSJ.com or on a client platform. The one I delved into was an elaborately produced online magazine called Curiosity that was created for a private bank, a fact that was utterly hidden in the magazine itself. There was ghosted text stating that the magazine was created in collaboration with WSJ Custom Studios, and in one other place I saw content is provided by WSJ Custom Studios, but that was it. More bizarre, though, was that the bank was barely mentioned at all, a new level of hidden marketing. On the newspaper site itself, though, the advertising aspect was clearly labeled. A heavy blue band containing the words "sponsor-generated content" runs across the top of the page, a fairly large sponsor logo is on the left, and the Custom Studios logo appears on the right. When you click on the blue bar, it states, "This content was paid for by an advertiser and created by the Wall Street Journal Advertising Department. The Wall Street Journal news organization was not involved in the creation of this content," making it more obvious than other sites. As the paper of record, the New York Times is held to a higher standard, and the expectation is thus that they will be the most cautious when it comes to avoiding confusion around advertising and editorial. The reviews are decidedly mixed. To debut its new site for native advertising, The New York Times created content for Netflix in conjunction with the launch of the second season of its hit show, Orange is the New Black. Across the top of the page is a light blue band that states "paid post." Under that is another band that includes the Times logo, followed by Brand Studio. It stands for T-Brand, the name of their in-house studio, on the left. And in the middle, the Netflix and Orange is the New Black logos appear. The URL, which likely few will look at, starts with paidpost.nytimes.com. Beyond this, however, the page looks like a journalistic piece in the Times. There is a headline, "Women Inmates, Why the Male Model Doesn't Work," a subhead, and what looks like a reporter's byline on top of an illustration of women heading into prison, the type that would appear with a typical story in the paper. The copy is interrupted by a video of women in prison and includes a clip from Piper Kerman, on whom the series is based. There is also a line in the article that says, "In an August 2013 op-ed in the New York Times, Piper Kerman, author of the prison memoir Orange is the New Black, which inspired the Netflix series of the same name, calls the distance between women prisoners and their families a second sentence. This native advertising is not only fundamentally different from the in-feed content of BuzzFeed, but even from other newspapers. This is in-depth reporting with visuals, infographics, and video, all professionally done, all visually appealing, all produced by T-Brand staff with both journalism and marketing credentials. That staff includes Adam Aston, a former Businessweek editor who has ghostwritten for brands, Melanie Diesel, a former staffer at Huffington Post's branded content studio as well as BuzzFeed, and news video producer Kaylee King Ballantyne. And it is evident that the paper is looking to do more, as they have said that they would like to increase their ranks to 35 in total. This is on par with the Washington Post, though about half the size of BuzzFeed's similar department. The piece on Orange is the New Black was followed by similar multimedia pieces for Cole Haan, Goldman Sachs, and Shell, and now there are as many as 3 pieces appearing in a single month. Interestingly, there is no website link to the T-Brand Studios on the Times website. Rather, it is housed in the Idea Lab. Much of this content contains beautiful photography and some infographics, but is light on copy. Several, The Surprising Cost of Not Taking a Vacation for MasterCard, and Distracted Parent, Distracted Teen for Toyota, are similar to the Netflix piece and include video, copy, and graphics. In each case, the content is uniquely tailored to the advertiser, so there are recipes for yogurt company Chobani, while photography is used to sell Costa Rica as a vacation destination. Like other traditional news organizations, there are disclaimers that the studio is intentionally and completely separate from our newsroom team, such that no members of our news or editorial staffs play a role in the creation of our branded content. We've gone to great lengths to make sure our content is distinguished and clearly labeled as advertising that comes from a marketer. Native advertising is not about tricking readers into thinking what they are reading is created by the New York Times newsroom. Rather, it is about providing readers with insightful and valuable content. Again, I turn to the astute analysis of FAIR's Janine Jackson, who believes they are being disingenuous at best. Native schnative, the New York Times should not be in the business of managing people's opinion of Goldman Sachs. There is no way that I can take as seriously the New York Times reporting on Goldman Sachs, knowing that they have just been on this content creation journey together. It very simply represents another example of news outlets doing pretty much the definition of selling out. Native advertising is just an effort to confuse readers to think that they're getting something other than an ad. Now, The Times finds itself in a difficult balancing act, as advertisers want proof that the native content works. T-Brand did research in conjunction with Chartbeat, a real-time web analytics company. This research must be taken with a grain of salt, however, as part of Chartbeat's business is to prove the monetizable value of quality content over clickbait. That said, the research found that T-Brand Studios content could go toe-to-toe with editorial in some cases. Looking at unique visitors, engagement, time on page, and visits via Facebook, Twitter, and Google, posts created by the newspaper performed better than those produced by the advertiser, which, of course, suggests that advertisers should use Times in-house services. Quote, the research also shows that while traffic on median-performing paid posts does not outperform traffic on median-performing nytimes.com editorial content, some high-performing T-Brand Studio posts receive enough traffic to generate as much engagement as some editorial content on nytimes.com. Among these was the Netflix ad, which was among the top 1,000 articles in the Times during 2014. This confirms what believers in Native say over and over again. Great stories can come from anywhere, and certainly from brands. Audiences will engage with great content, regardless of its provenance, provided they have a sense of where it's coming from. Comments like that raise concerns among critics. The New York Times can create content that looks like news. While the Orange is the New Black ad was not derided like the Scientology one, it did raise concerns, mostly because it is a serious piece of journalism. It was written by Melanie Diesel, who has legitimate news credentials. Now, however, she is an editor and social media strategist of T-Brand Studio, which ultimately means that she answers to an advertiser, whether that is consciously acknowledged or not. This makes Native advertising problematic. It can lead to solid, well-researched content being produced. But is it journalism? It may also be content that the newspaper might not have produced without corporate support. If that's the case, we have to ask ourselves, why not? It might simply be a matter of economics. This came up as part of a conversation I had with Jeff Pundyke, the Vice President of Global Integrated Content Solutions at The Economist. He noted that Native advertising allows the publication to cover content they would not have been able to afford. That's a good thing on its face. However, journalistic principles exist for reportage that do not exist for advertising, the most important of those being that reporters are trained to present at least two sides of a story. This is not awkward for BuzzFeed or Vice, but it is for The New York Times and The Economist and The Guardian, which has a long-running seven-figure deal with Unilever around their sustainability initiatives. The full brunt of the kind of conflicts of interest that can arise came to light in the UK when Peter O'Born, The Telegraph's chief political commentator, quit because he believed the newspaper was being soft on investigating questions related to tax evasion, rigged currency markets, and racism against Muslims by HSBC, one of their largest advertisers. The collapsing wall of church and state led not only to simply inept reporting, but to an outright fraud on readers. Newspapers are scrambling for readers, particularly young readers, so this was no isolated incident. Native advertising, too, is a fraud, if not properly labeled. Yet there is no evidence that publishers are moving in the direction of being clear about labels on sponsored content. As further evidence that publishers will continue to slowly but surely cave to advertisers, The Times toned down the labeling on their sponsored posts, just like Twitter did, and they did it in response to advertiser concerns that readers would not give the content a chance if they knew it was advertising. In-house ad agencies like these are not limited to the print stalwarts. New companies coming to Native include CBS Interactive, and online publications like Gawker, Fast Company, and Mashable, in addition to sites like Salon, Slate, and Vox mentioned earlier, are fully immersed in Native custom content. NBCU recently announced investments in both Vox and BuzzFeed, which is likely to create Native mashups we haven't even begun to imagine. Mashable and Fast Company I find to be already particularly opaque. It is often only when my ad detector app kicks in that I know I'm looking at sponsored content. More on ad blockers and ad detectors in Chapter 6. The most hidden ads are on one of millennials' favorite sites, Vice. I spent hours trying to figure out what content on the Vice website was advertising. I knew it was there because I knew Vice used almost exclusively Native, but I couldn't find it. Is the article about a new documentary about Leon Russell an ad for the film, or simply an interview with the filmmakers? What about the article about Kanye West that conveniently includes an Adidas video that shows the $200 sneaker he designed and which sold out in hours? It's hard to tell for sure. Here, there are no labels of sponsorship of any kind. I did finally find an area where they provide case studies of past campaigns, which included video content, a one-off or a series, and devoted websites known as verticals. For hair company Garnier Fructis, for example, Vice placed the product on its music channel, Noisy. Bringing together style, hair, and music, Vice created Style Stage, which included video and written content focusing on music talent appealing to a young target audience. This initiative included a series called Style Files about emerging artists with amazing hair, including product integrations and styling, and music videos with product integration. The campaign also featured a launch party at South by Southwest with styling stations and sampling opportunities, a college bus tour, and both online and offline auditions for the host of the original series, Headhunter. Separately, Vice ran a venture with Intel called the Creators Project, which explores the juncture between art and technology, and for which Intel has reportedly paid tens of millions of dollars. More typically, Vice creates videos for marketers that begin with presented by XYZ company, much as feature films begin with producer logos. In all, the corporate sponsorship is as obscured as possible. Because Vice has tentacles in a number of media properties, including digital, print, and television, Vice on HBO, the company has multiple ways to drive traffic from one platform to another, with considerable assistance from their millennial admirers. Another example of a company that is very much in this mode is Refinery29, a one-time fashion and style hyper-local blog that has now expanded into news and political content targeted to a millennial female audience. Founded in 2005, the site has become so successful in attracting this audience and advertisers that it is often considered to be an equal player with print stalwarts Vogue and InStyle. With ambitions to expand globally, the company recently announced that they had received investment funding from media company Scripps Network Interactive and the advertising giant WPP. Like other sites, the company is looking to expand its video content and to push video distribution through social and mobile, as well as, like Vice, through television. In praising this site, content marketer Sachin Kamdar of Parsley said that their content is excellent. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish between Refinery29's editorial content and its branded content, meaning that they're both equally engaging. Starting to sound familiar? According to the company's website, people around the world spent more than 3.6 million hours on the site, which is more than 150,000 days, or 411 years. And what were people reading in all that time? Everything. Stories ranging from runway trends and beauty DIYs to dating disaster stories and articles featuring the latest world news, all with our signature Refinery29 wink, of course. Yes, and how much of that engaging content was advertising? That they do not say. The blurred lines between editorial and content are becoming fuzzier by the day. Condé Nast, publishers of notable magazines like GQ, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker, among many others, is not even pretending to keep editorial and advertising separate. With their studio, called 23 Stories by Condé Nast, the publisher is having magazine editors work directly with marketers. Perhaps they feel emboldened to do this because of one of the key arguments for native advertising. If the advertising is good enough, people will enjoy it as much as they appreciate editorial content. The next sentence is usually, "Just look at Vogue. Women read it for the ads as much as the articles." By integrating the work, Condé Nast can offer advertisers seamless content across platforms. This seems to be a bellwether of things to come. Already, the Daily Mail uses reporters to write both news and branded content for its website. On the other side of the equation, marketing guru Seth Godin recommends that companies hire editors instead of brand managers, advice I hope they do not heed. A recent article called "What Content Marketers Can Learn from Journalists" touts the growing trend of journalists becoming content marketers and how they bring their storytelling and writing skills to marketing. As this trend continues, readers need to be suspicious about any and all editorial content, whether it is labeled or not. Value to advertisers and publishers, problems for consumers. As we have seen, proponents of native ads, and there are many, say that companies and their marketing allies can create content as interesting as anything published in a newspaper. Further, these companies are also experts in their field, so they can provide better information on that field than someone outside the industry might. Since display ads are becoming less and less effective, publishers have to make money somehow, and native ads can help fill the void. Critics, including me, have said that if the content is that good, companies should be proud to put their name on it. Misleading readers will only come back to hurt the publisher and the advertiser. And in the case of the advertiser, if consumers don't realize that there's a brand associated with some engaging and interesting content, what is the advertiser actually buying? A number of advertisers have begun to realize this, and they have been discussing it with publishers. Advertisers want the ad to be native, but not too native. Unfortunately, that conflicts with publishers' desire for native to be ultra-camouflaged. Bottom line, native advertising is about making money for publishers and advertisers. The way to do that is to get us to read and engage with content for longer periods of time. They claim they are giving us what we want, but I'm not convinced that's true. Do we really want one-sided presentations like Scientology? No, and I doubt we want that sort of content from Shell or Unilever either. But far worse, do we want that sort of content produced in a way that's indistinguishable from legitimate journalism? If we believe what publishers say, they really have drunk the Kool-Aid. Jay Luff, the publisher of The Atlantic, has said, "A lot of people worry about crossing editorial and advertising lines, but I think it respects readers more. It's saying, you know what you're interested in. It's more respectful of the reader that way." Paul Rossi, managing editor of The Economist, put it a bit differently. "The opportunity for media companies is to create content that's compelling for users on behalf of advertisers. The real issue is, how do you make content that's compelling to a reader that doesn't feel like an ad? That's the real challenge." And Time Inc.'s CEO, Joe Ripp, told Bloomberg TV, "Not are we violating church and state, whatever that was. We ask, are we violating our trust with our consumers?" Certainly, it was not so long ago that he would have referred to his audience as readers, not consumers. Behind closed doors, it is hard to imagine that these publishers are not conflicted. On the one hand, they need to provide sponsored content that consumers will click. On the other, they need to make sure people don't become irritated when they realize they've been clickbaited into reading advertising. And publishers have to do this all while maintaining some semblance of journalistic integrity. This is certainly worse for what was a venerable institution like Time Inc. than it is for a digital newbie like BuzzFeed. The concern I heard from most people in the field was the issue of transparency, and that fear is not unfounded. Recent research by the Association of National Advertisers found that transparency was the single biggest issue for advertisers using native, and 2/3 said that the advertising needs appropriate disclosure information. But what one says on a survey is not necessarily what happens in practice. Ben Williams, digital editor at New York Magazine, says, "Especially on the internet, there's a long tradition of new media companies being willing to blur edit ad boundaries." Vice is the perfect example here. In April 2014, they ran an article with the title, "Talking to Girls About the Good Old Number 2 Taboo." As only Vice will do, the piece was accompanied by young women pulling up their underwear while walking out of a bathroom or sitting on a toilet with their underwear around their ankles. Below these pictures were captions noting what they were wearing, mostly from American Apparel, an advertiser known for presenting scantily clad nubile models, as well as Dr. Martens, Reebok, and a few others. While the site said that no money exchanged hands, there was an in-kind donation of apparel, and nowhere was the piece marked as sponsored. Traditional publishers, however, cannot, or should not, stray too far, or they risk alienating advertisers who want to be associated with a venerable reputation. Dell and Netflix and Shell get the patina of authority on a site like the New York Times that they can't get from an online publisher, even if they do have to pay for it. These companies want to be sure that consumers are not being bamboozled. And while the sites I looked at did show that the content was sponsored, I have serious concerns about whether readers absorb that information, particularly on sites where the sponsor information disappears once you scroll down the page. Native advertising is so new that there is limited good independent research as to what consumers know or don't know about it. What exists, however, is telling. In December 2015, Bartosz W. Wojcinski and Nathaniel J. Evans from the University of Georgia published research which found that only 8% of participants were able to recognize content as advertising. In a smaller study out of Berkeley's Law and Technology Center, Chris J. Hufnagel and Edward Melashinsky demonstrated that even when content was labeled sponsored by, more than half the participants either thought it was written by a journalist or were unclear about who was behind that content. In writing about this study, Amar Bakshi notes that the Berkeley research likely underestimates consumer confusion because subjects were alerted to pay attention and evaluate an article with specific instructions to decide if it had been written by a reporter. In the real world, readers easily overlook textual clues in the rush of typical web behavior. The Georgia study concludes by mirroring what I have been suggesting throughout this book, stating, "The growth in native advertising might not be because the customers find it intrinsically compelling, but because many of them do not recognize it well enough to apply the avoidance and defense strategies they have developed for other types of online ads." In 2013, corporate research demonstrated similar findings in that 85% of consumers had never heard of native ads. Today, though, people are more aware of this type of sponsored content, even if they cannot put a name on it. We know they are more aware because they protest that it is misleading. They feel most deceived by sponsored video ads. 86% report that they find those ads misleading, while 57% feel similarly about Facebook-sponsored stories and 45% about Twitter-promoted tweets. Until recently, most people have not been aware of the various forms these ads take. Once the truth fully comes to light, the value of native advertising will diminish. When that happens, native advertising may simply become another place where ad avoidance will occur. And if that happens, advertisers will need to obscure the sponsor mention still further.